started, I didn't, the bus did leave, right?
Yep.
So they're kind of finding their way. We, some of you are familiar from other days, and some of you are not. So if I can introduce myself, I'm Dr. Merit Trelstad from Pacific Lutheran University, and I teach in the religion department there. And I teach, my PhD was in the philosophy of religion and theology, and then I've taught constructive theology, Lutheran theology, feminist and womanist theology at PLU, so, and classics and all of that kind of, so Christian theology. And constructive theology is simply the word that they're using for systematic theology. So that's my area, and what we've been looking at over the course of the week is this idea of Lutheran theology in particular, and whether Lutheran theology has the potential to inspire or hamper political social action. Are there some things? Last night and the day before, we looked at, thank you, Bonhoeffer's work and the influences on his decisions to be politically active, and whether they came out of Lutheran theology or not. This was something that, and we talked about how, whether it's just his makeup or his background or something, there is a little bit more of a seamless connection, I think, between his abstract ideas moving into his, abstract and Lutheran theological ideas moving into his life and political action. And today we'll look at Namibia. And in Namibia, the question, these questions about the Garrison Keillor typification or caricature of Lutherans, of whether this is true, and Lutherans really are passive or quiet and don't want to really make a fuss, or whether this is just North American Lutherans, and if so, is there something wrong with us if the Lutherans in Namibia are the political guerrillas and we're passive? And these questions came, I was thinking, the first day I talked a little bit about how these questions were generated, and Namibia is a bit near and dear to me because I was raised in a pretty quietistic, I mean, my grandpa really never talked. So, I mean, when I'm saying quiet, I mean, really, literally quiet people. I mean, you shouldn't really talk if you don't have anything to say. My mom said their mealtimes as children, it was just silent, pretty much. And as kids, you didn't talk if the grown-ups weren't talking. That was their time to talk. But they were both pretty quiet, so they just didn't talk. Or, you know, she says, you know, the calamity of, you know, they had a huge hailstorm, wipes out the whole crop. And she said, and her father just turned around, you know, there's no income for the year. And this is right after in her childhood, right around the Depression. And so he turns around and he says, well, that fixed the corn borers, which are like the bugs, the pests, right? And just walks away. And that's the last that they talked about it. I mean, it was like, so we don't talk about it. It's not even worth it. I mean, we have to deal with it, but why talk about it? So I came from that kind of a background. The Garrison Keillor, I guess it probably typifies some of the Lutheranism that I was familiar with. And then in college, I was introduced to liberation theology and all these interesting kind of radical Christian movements, political activist movements, that I didn't really know if the Lutherans were doing it or not. I hadn't really heard about them yet. And I went to seminary, and that seemed almost taboo, because sometimes when you talk about social justice, it was like, oh, you're one of those. And really, Lutheran theology, you're going to get too caught up in this works righteousness kind of stuff, and works of merit, and sanctification. It's all in here. So, you know, that you're going to get better and better over time. You're not, you know, that's, so get over it. So there's a number of things that I thought, oh, this is odd. But I had the chance, I had a friend who was teaching in the Peace Corps in Botswana. So I finished college, this was prior to going to seminary. I was exposed to the political guerrillas. That's probably why my question of like, well, doesn't this have something to do with politics? No, you know. So in a couple classes, not all of them at seminary. But after college, I was a youth director for a couple years, and I quit that job. I knew I was going to seminary to do an MDiv, but I went the MA track instead and PhD track. So I knew I was going there, so I took some time, about half a year, and went to Southern Africa. I had a friend who was in the Peace Corps teaching English in Botswana. So I went there, and I volunteered at a Black Lutheran church in Namibia that her family... it was a congregation in Redwood Falls, Minnesota, that had a sister congregation in southern Namibia. So through them, I arranged an internship where I just said, you know, I'll pay my lodging and things like that, and then and my way, my lodging, you don't have to pay me anything. I just want to be there and just see what being Lutheran in Namibia is like. So I had gone there, and that was in 1992. In March 1992, and in 19, it had just been 2 years since the apartheid system, since Namibia was free, and apartheid had been abolished, and there was new black elected officials in Sam Nujoma, who was their a big head leader of one of the organizations we'll look at called SWAPO, and in an independence movement there. So I had gone there and spent a couple months at this congregation, and I was confused about what I actually was supposed to do. I thought they might have, I wrote random job recommendations because I could type, and that was a big thing. You know, people I've never met would come and sit down, and that was part of my job, you know, thing was to write them job recommendations. So tell me about yourself, you know, and I'd write up something and send it off. The other thing I did that they said was the most important thing for me to do, and this is when I was saying, what am I doing? Like, what can I do that's the most helpful? And they said, you know, I hate to tell you this, but actually just being white, it was a Black Lutheran church in the Black township. And they said, we kind of just want you to be white and be here so that people can see us working together and that this is what it's supposed to look like. And white people did not drive. There were always white people have black drivers. And so the fact that I was driving the church truck around and picking people up, picking up the black congregation members, you know, and bringing them back to the township or kind of playing taxi in the city, they said, you really don't even know how funny this is. Like, I mean, this looks so funny. And so I was like, okay, can you drive this? I can drive it, you know. Can you drive... in a line of cars with more than one lane, I was like, yes, I'm from a city with many lanes, you know, I can drive in a line with many lanes. So, but it was a very odd experience, I guess, because really not much of the apartheid structures had been really dismantled, so at that time. And I think things had changed some, and I've been back there one more time. So I think some of the things have changed a little bit, but at that time it was really segregated. And I know the United States has a history of this as well. So the South Africans loved to pick you. Hitchhiking was normal. It was a normal form of transportation. And the South Africans or white Namibians would like to pick you up and as a United States person and telling you, like, well, sounds like LA is going up in flames. So I guess you have your race problems too. It's just that we're honest about it, you know. So they just thought it was, you know. So there was the black township, the colored township, and the white township area in each city. It was segregated after the 1960s. So, and there were different schools. You were not allowed to live in another place. So if you were, you could always, a colored person could, and colored meant anyone who was in between. From India, from a mixed race person, that was the catch-all for everything in between. So if you had a white parent and a black parent, you would probably live in a colored township, and things were better. The housing was significantly better than the black township, so you gained status for that. And there were a number of things that... even the white woman who ran the store, we went to it the first time, and she was talking to me. And the next, after that, she never spoke to me again. And I said, I can't understand. I mean, you'd go up and you'd say, hello, good morning, and you'd be buying things. There was no words. And she'd just exchange the money. And I walked out and said, yeah, and they said, she's not talking to you because you're here with us. She thought you were, you know, white in the city. but now you're living with us, it's clear, and, you know, that's over. So she's not going to greet you like that again. So there are a number of odd interactions. So there's a white Lutheran church there as well, a small German-speaking white Lutheran church, and I have not researched the impact of the independence movement on them. It's a much smaller church. But 44 to 50% of all Namibians, and it was a little bit higher before the Pentecostal movements took hold, so it was in the 70s, percent of all Namibians were Lutheran. So that's why it's so interesting for Lutherans here. I mean, it's a huge, much, much more in the Pacific Northwest. Lutherans share we're 4% of the population, but that 4% is shared among all Protestants. Is one of the statistics. Catholics is 7%. That's the highest religious affiliation denomination of the Pacific Northwest. All Protestants land in the 4. So when you get a country that's 44 to 50, you know, this is significant. And now, so we have this idea of our Lutherans, what's the motivation here? And it was a significant experience. I hadn't experienced that form because I'm white and in this country, hadn't experienced that form and level of racism and the overtness of it. I think that was also shocking. And when you went into the black homelands, there was a funeral there, and I was the only white person. And they said, "You're the only one who's in recorded memory who's been here. Nobody who's white has been here. So you will be different." They said, "There will be 2,500 people. You'll have a hard time finding us because it'll be like dark when, you know, the whole night of mourning and things." And they said, "But we'll have no problem finding you." And it was true. You just felt like you were it was so embarrassing. I'm still embarrassed talking about it. You just like glowed white, and children cried when they were handed to you, and old women slapped your leg and laughed in your face and stuff like that. It was just like, this is just also humiliating. And then the people wanted me to talk about death at like midnight or 1 in the morning. The people would like you to speak about death. I'm like, really? I'm 24. You want me to stand up and speak to these, you know, these matriarchs, these big matriarchs sitting in the front row, this grand, you know, strong women? I thought, oh gosh, I would just sooner die. All right, I'd love to speak about death. Sure, give me a minute, okay? Give me a minute. I'll think of something. So it was a strange experience. But this is where, in the descriptions for the course over the week, the pastors, in walking between the colored and the black townships one morning, one of them said, you know you're living with the gorillas, right? And I said, I do know that. Yeah, I do know that. Another way that I learned that was, former bishop of the ALC, David Preuss, his daughter is my best friend, and I lived in their basement, and he had been to Namibia several times, so he said, I know people in Namibia, go look them up, call them, give them a call, and, they'll probably invite you over for dinner, or things like this, and I thought, oh, great, this is nice. So I wrote down the names, and he said, I'm sure they've got a phone book or someplace, so you can look it up. And I was just a regular backpacker going to this church. And I went to I couldn't find it, so I went to the tourist stand, and said, can you help, or information, can you help me? I have these people I'm supposed to contact, and I don't have a phone book. She said, I can look them up for you. Who are they? And I start saying the names of these people, and she stops, and she looks at me, and she says, who are you? I was like, I'm not anybody. I was like, I'm just a visitor. I'm not a tourist. And she said, well, these are our major political, these are our leaders. These are our major people. It would be like walking in, into the South and saying, I'd like the phone number for Dr. Martin Luther King. Do you happen to have that on hand? Or, so I just chickened out and I didn't call any of them. So that was my response, was like that. I didn't understand, and I really don't want to, I don't know what I'll say. I should have just called and said, I'm bringing greetings from these people, and it would have been a very interesting ride, but instead I just completely chickened out. I was like, okay, I'm not anybody. I'm not a reporter. So I went back in 2005 with a group of faculty, and I was determined this time to actually talk to these people and actually interview them, because I'd read their history and I learned more about them. And the fact that they're Lutheran, and had developed that question more of this question. of what are Lutherans and what are our bases for action. And so I went back and did contact them and spent some time with them. And then this last year I got a, sorry this is taking so long, but it sets a little bit of context. The faculty student research grant to a student of mine was going over to Namibia for a semester. And it's very hard to get print material and a lot of materials on Namibia and Namibian history outside of Namibia. And the work of philosophers and theologians there, here, across the ocean. It's hard to get them there, and it's even more difficult to get them here. So I sent her to get materials and then do, this time, recorded interviews, because I had just handwritten stuff in 2005. So recorded interviews with as many of these people as she could track down. And then, so she's been researching it as well. So this is a work in progress, actually, of looking at these influences on Namibian history. I'll give you a few dates. This is just, I don't have, I guess the, it's down here, the date of this, 1976, from an artist in Namibia, the Evangelical Lutheran Church Women's Meeting. It says at the top, and I thought I'd give you just a few images, dates, and pictures. And at the end of this, what we'll do is we'll talk about, in hearing this, what kinds of questions you may have or thoughts you may have, and then also of saying what are elements, if you've thought of it, and I have a sheet too on Lutheran theology, Luther's theology. If you're Lutheran or if you come from a different Christian denomination, what are some theological ideas that may be in your tradition that would either support or hinder political, social engagement? Okay. Some key dates. So 1915, the South African army overthrows German colonizers in Namibia and takes it. In 1921, you have the League of Nations granting South Africa Namibia as a sacred trust of civilization. That's what it's called in the document. So as a result, by 1923, white settlers formed only 10% of the population in Namibia, but they possessed over 95% of the land. This was still very true. One of the, just a couple of years after apartheid, so 70 years later. So for example, sitting at a white farm, with the white farm owners, I'd been hitchhiking and a very, very nice white family picked me up. They were not celebrating Independence Day that year. I asked them what they were doing for the holiday, for Independence Holiday, and they said, "We don't celebrate Independence." I was like, "That's right, you don't." That's right. But sitting in this living room after a nice ride around having some, they asked me, they said, "Would you open the curtains behind you? Because the workers want to watch TV." And the TV was in front of me in the living room, and the window was behind me. And I open up the window, and there's about 250 black workers sitting behind my back on the concrete, looking over. So they're going to watch TV over my shoulder with no sound while I sit in the room. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, and luckily my host family says, "Why don't we leave?" I was like, "That's a good idea," because it was one of those things where you're thinking, now what do I do? I'm in the middle of nowhere. So it's not a Bonhoeffer moment, but it was one of those things where you, yes, 95% of the land owned. 1962, apartheid laws adopted officially in Namibia, so there's different rights, different education, different housing opportunities, education opportunities given depending on your race and your racial background profile. 1966, the United Nations, replacing a general replacement to this League of Nations, revokes South Africa's mandate and places Namibia under the jurisdiction of the UN. And in 1971, the International Court of Justice, The Hague, confirms that 1966 resolution of the UN. So at this point, the Lutheran leaders start getting active of saying, and by 1986, there's letters saying, "We have been illegally occupied for 20 years after it's been internationally declared that we should have an independent government." So then the fighting gets pretty severe in the 1980s because it's now it's been recognized internationally. So the Lutheran church leaders send this open letter to the president of South Africa, and it's timed so that it arrives at the president's office at the same time that all the Lutheran churches read it out loud on Sunday morning to their congregations. So it's a bunch of uppity recent graduates from the seminary so that decide to get involved, and they write this open letter, and it's read all over in the Namibian churches. And we'll see some of the people. So the letter declares the illegal occupation of Namibia, and in the words of a couple of the leaders, they say it was read out loud at all the Lutheran churches so that the people know that the church is with them and that the church stands with them. In 1975, Kamita, one of the main authors of that open letter, is arrested under the South African, I threw this in for us because I thought it was interesting, Terrorism Act is what it was called. The Terrorism Act, the South African Terrorism Act, gave police unprecedented rights to arrest and place detainees in solitary confinement. So many other church leaders and members are arrested or killed in the resistance movement. You have, it's not quite like El Salvador with the slaughter of the priests. It's not to that extent in Namibia. South Africa, we have, you know, all the more famous stories of Mandela and Tutu and the, we can name other Biko. Ones. Biko, yes, Stephen Biko, and a number of the people. And those role models are important here in Namibia, too, because it's going on all over. But in Namibia, so Kamita is arrested for some time. And he becomes the person who's right after, he's elected bishop of the Lutheran Church right after independence and becomes the Lutheran World Federation General Secretary and things like this. So he's the Nelson Mandela kind of character of the Lutheran Church. And he was the one on the slide right before this, I can go back to. 1990, March 21st, so Namibia is declared independent, forges its constitution. The Independence Day celebration in 1992 that a couple of us just happened upon, which was a great reggae festival. We were, as foreigners, the white people there, and many people did not want to dance with us, and that was understandable. And then other people were insistent that we dance with people, like they were making us dance with people, like we have to be one. I was like, oh gosh, this is awesome. This is really interesting. But there were armed guards standing all around the top. So the whole time, it was very odd. Celebration to have all these military people behind there. So some of these key leaders and organizations in the Namibia independence struggle, some of the Lutheran leaders, this Bishop Zephaniah Kamita, and again, he's back. I have a book of his. I'll read a couple. I can read a little bit, and then I'll pass it around to you. Toward Liberation, Crossing Boundaries Between Church and Politics is a compilation of letters and things that he wrote. That someone had put together for him. So Bishop of the Lutheran Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in the Republic of Namibia, and the former secretary of the LWF. And the ELCRN was the sister Lutheran Church to the ELCA. So these were, that was, because there was the White Lutheran Church too, but that was not, that was declared, our Lutheran Church did denounce that church as being doing injustice. It didn't just say, you know, everyone's all right here. We've got, let's go through this and then I can read just a little bit of Kamita's letters. Bishop Cleopas Domeni and his predecessor Bishop Owala, Bishop Shejavali, he's Abbasai Shejavali, and his wife Salma Shejavali has been a big part of the women's movements across Namibia and still today for women's rights and justice and things, continuing that. So his wife has been actually a major political figure as well there. And Nakamala, and there'll be a couple intellectual. Paul John Isaac, I have a little piece that's sitting out here somewhere that was his book. Is that it? It might be. The Religion and Society. You can pass that around too. This is one book by, he's at the University of Namibia in Windhoek, their capital. Which is right about here. The church I was at was down here, and it's very empty. And the black homelands, at least for that area, are over here, and it is just dirt. I've never been any place like it. It's like the moon. There is you can grow nothing on those black homelands. People go out there, but I mean, it is dirt with, there was one bush in the distant horizon. I've never been any place so flat and so without vegetation as those homelands. So a letter to the brothers and sisters. This was from Kmita on his arrest. And I thought, we talked about Bonhoeffer last night. And it's interesting because Bonhoeffer has his letters and papers from prison. Kmita is somebody, Bonhoeffer's work is not used by a lot of the Namibian theologians, but Kmita uses him. He uses more Bonhoeffer than Luther. And Kmita is expressly disinterested in abstract theological ideas. He doesn't think human rights need and social justice, that we have to start in the abstract world. We just start with people's needs. It makes a lot of sense. We start there. So, but when he does refer to abstract things, he talks in terms of Bonhoeffer's terms, and they even termed the post-1971, the Lutheran churches called themselves the Confessing Church, just like they did in Bonhoeffer's Germany. So it's kind of an interesting connection there, and talks about the church as spokes in the wheel. So Kmita writes this, a letter to brothers and sisters. To all who by word and deed stand by us in the struggle, to all who by day and by night bring our case before the Lord, dear brothers and sisters, right at the outset, I should like on behalf of my wife and children and all Namibians to thank you most sincerely for all your prayers and support during the past days and weeks. Once it has become clear that the South African government is not dealing with just a small band of agitators and terrorists, but with thousands of Christians around the world, and with all who, irrespective of their faith or nationality, stand for what is right and just. Through this letter, I wish to share with you some of the thoughts which I had while, like many others, I was locked up in solitary confinement. Many questions were roused in me, and I want to discuss these with you. Have these events not perhaps estranged me from Jesus, our Savior? Many people must have put this question to themselves and come to the conclusion these people are only interested in politics and are far removed from Jesus and his church, or these people no longer follow the Lord as their personal Savior. My purpose here is not to bring accusations against anyone or to defend myself. I had to face these questions, be it in a different form, but allow me to share with you what I experienced in jail. I tried to look back on my life, and here I must honestly say that I have never lived so closely day and night with the Word of God as I did during my 3 weeks of detention. Before, I had always read the Word with an eye to other people. I always asked, what does the Word of God say to them? But in these three weeks, I began to ask, what does the Word of God say to me in this situation? I not only studied His Word, I experienced it, and that's in capitals. Every word and sentence took on a new meaning for me in those days. I felt very strongly that the Lord Himself was speaking to me. I knew no language or words in which I could describe what I experienced in those days with the Word of God. In these days, Jesus became anew my Savior. There were days during which I experienced great doubt, especially when I thought of His words, ask and you shall receive. Why does He not free us? I asked myself. I thought of my wife and children. I thought of the scores of wives and children and girlfriends of my fellow prisoners. Oh, Lord, how long? I asked accusingly and doubtingly. I argued aloud with the Lord in my cell. Lord, if you are a God, then you must liberate Namibia now. In those days, I expected that the Lord should act according to my will. There were also moments when anxiety took over. He says, the struggle in our land not only has to do with the liberation of Namibia, but it goes further and deeper than that. The presence of the South African government is not just a political question, but it is a threat to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thus, I see it as a task of every Christian to work for the knocking down of this government. In this country which claims to be Christian, you can be a Christian 10,000 times over, but if you are not white, you are treated like a dog. And then at the end, that was where the terrorism act was we talked about. So a few words there from him, and we'll any question on leaders or on any of the things that I've talked about so far? Just pause. Yeah.
Question with regard to the media and how that had an impact in Namibia. I know with Biko and Cry Right Season and the Cry Freedom movies, it was a white journalist that fomented and helped. Was there any of that in Namibia as well?
This I don't know. I don't know that answer to that question. That's a great question. The churches were very present, though. I think that the international churches were getting involved. So, but I don't know. Great question. It's So I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. Some of the organizations there that I've thrown up there are the Lutheran Church and the Council of Churches in Namibia. Although I don't think it was as famous. I can't say that. I can't come up with a movie on it. I can't come up. Yeah.
Kamita was here at Holden in the fall of the early 80s one year for a theological conference. And so somewhere back in the archives here is his address that was recorded during that time. So
It was for a fall theological conference, so it would have been September.
With Carl Broughton and
Walt Weingren
Jr.
had like three more diverse speakers.
Wow, yeah, so that's something for all of us to look at. That's what we should have brought in here today. Holy smokes, there you go. You've got it right there.
And they did them. In this very room, they did a panel discussion with those three. And it was just so fascinating because it was, like I say, you couldn't have had three more diverse people in terms of their backgrounds and where they were coming from and their experiences and stuff. So,
and what they find authoritative, I think that's going to be part of, I mean, where you start with your theology and your reflection on the Word of God. I think that's going to be really huge. So very different, and by that I mean the Kamita has expressed disrespect for starting with abstract Lutheran doctrine. And I would believe that Broughton, he's quite a bit. I mean, that's what his life has been working on it. And in a good, he's been one of our only people who's recognizable outside of Lutheranism, outside our Lutheran ghetto of theology talk. So he's big. I mean, he's been a big thinker. But it would be a pretty interesting where you start your theology. The Lutheran Church and the Council of Churches in Namibia, their headquarters were bombed by the South African Army during the war. That was one big event that shaped that you knew that the churches were stirring something up. SWAPO is an interesting organization. So the president, who became the president after Liberation, was a part of SWAPO and a leader of SWAPO. And SWAPO it had some headquarters in Angola, and it had some communist Marxist philosophical background, but, you know, a lot of people would say, but a lot of Lutheran church members were also a part of SWAPO. But the problem was, I think pastors, there was this unease. It's controversial slightly because SWAPO did do some torturing. It captured some South Africans, brought them into Angola, and did detain them and torture them. And that was not the policy of some of the Lutheran church leaders, or how they thought it should be gone about. But then again, some were involved with it. So that idea of, do you take up arms? To what extent do you take up arms? And then who do you hold hands with during this process? Because SWAPO was pretty powerful. So the Lutheran churches and SWAPO. And the Marxist atheist thing also gets lots of airplay of the concerns about SWAPO. But Kamita was able to do this pretty well and negotiate these pretty well. But afterwards then he was a critic of the government after independence for the unjust land distribution and things that were still going on. And so he is somebody, I mentioned the first day of class, that Kamita's remained a controversial kind of troublemaker. He's always critiquing somebody in power, and usually people who have been his dear friends, so he's a wild card. But everybody points to him. He's huge. The People's Liberation Army is also connected to, it's a little bit different, it's connected to SWAPO and kind of the military angle, but it also had its own organization as well. And then they're interconnected. This is a terrible picture. I don't have the pixels on that. You have Abisai Shejavali is one of the main bishops and the Council of Churches president during the fight. And Desmond Tutu, and then there he is, a little bit older, Abisai Shejavali, and Bishop Cleopas Dumeni at a church rally down below, and outside the church gathering during the revolution. I just thought that, you know, it's, I don't want to be National Geographic or kind of glamorize or make people seem, you know, exotic or something for being outside, but really sitting on the benches out in the hot sun, that was a big part of my experience in Namibia with the church too. Yeah. It'd be 110, you know, and you'd just be out there for 4.5 hours while the pastor talked. So you'd kind of sit out. This was the scenario even still. Lots of the marriages and funerals. Okay, a few more things, and then I will stop talking and take some questions. So, in our research so far, in trying to look at what are the bases of the liberation struggle, here was my concern, really, in 2005, was I would ask these Lutheran bishops, I'd say, so you're a Lutheran bishop, yes. So what out of your Lutheran church background kind of, you know, inspired this, your political activism? They kind of pause. And they'd almost invariably say, far more Christian principles, you know, are we all created equally or not? And we are. So, therefore, we have to be a spokesperson for the for the church. And then they would say, almost invariably as well, at that time, have you ever read the work of James Cone? And who's a black North American liberation theologian. In our civil rights movement. So they said Martin Luther King Jr., James Cone, we read Black Theology, The God of Liberation, we read a little bit of Latin American liberation theology of Gustavo Gutierrez, and that's also busting out between, there is from 1969 to 1975, you have publications in Mary Daly writes Beyond God the Father, kind of a first start of feminist thought, and Gustavo Gutierrez is writing God of the Oppressed. James Cone is publishing in 1969 about his black liberation theology. So right around that time of that open letter, it's all busting out in the United States and all over too. So in Latin America, liberation theology ideas. And they referred to those, but they weren't, none of those are Lutherans. They weren't referring to Mary Daly either, but they weren't, none of them were Lutherans that they were saying to me. And I was like, no Lutherans? I mean, like, so all these Lutherans in the theological conversations up here in North America, they weren't saying we were reading Gerhard Ferdy and going out and fighting the, you know, South Africans. Or I was thinking, this is interesting. Nobody's showing up. How about Martin Luther? Was he interesting? But I kept asking these questions and getting this. So this time I think we have a little bit more of sending her back and asking, but not for people to falsely attribute. I don't want that. You know, you do want to find out what it was. So some of the influences they reported, really, the experience of oppression, number one, and the need for the church to represent the people, these basic Christian understandings concerning the dignity of all, that everyone's created in the image of God. Number two, they talked about biblical theology, reading the Sermon on the Mount, the prophets, the Exodus story, and the release of from slavery. This was huge. And they said, so it wasn't, they'll even say, Lutheran theology, not so much. Biblical theology, yes, which is a Protestant putting the Bible in the hands of the people and letting them read it and interpret it. And that's a Protestant principle that had some effect in Namibia. So I was thinking, well, that's something there. The life of Jesus. Like I mentioned, North American black liberation theology, James Cone, late 1960s to early 1970s. These are formative publications, some of Latin American liberation theology, Martin Luther King Jr. So James Cone, the thing, he had one statement where he said, God is black. That was, I mean, I think even as an undergraduate, I read the James Cone, one of his early works where he says, so if you are white, because God always sides with the oppressed and is in the image of the oppressed. So right now, God is black. So if you are white, you should think about that very seriously. So James Cone was very forward on that, and not very, he's become more conciliatory, I would say, through the years, but initially there were much stronger declarative statements by Cone and his theology. While Kmita doesn't want to credit abstract theology or doctrine for motivation, he clearly follows Bonhoeffer's ideas. They're referenced. And he quotes Bonhoeffer occasionally. He calls, they called, sorry, I should say, their church the Confessing Church, and he uses Bonhoeffer's idea of the church and believers being spokes in the wheel of change. It was also a reaction to South African state theology. These were Che Jivali's words that referred to the divinely ordained government. One of the things, Romans 13 comes up all the time in how they had to, this was thrown in their face, the Bible was thrown in their faces, like this is, we're put over you and it's a divinely ordained. And Luther doesn't help on that. So there was also a clear divine manifest destiny idea that the land had been given to them by God. This is very clear in the South Africans talking about their experience themselves. Different, there are different groups of white South Africans, but especially the Boer people in South Africa talk about this kind of, it's a manifest destiny story of their time. All right, so, and then we'll stop. This is quite a bit. So Lutheran themes that were important to some degree. So one or two of them refer to Luther's idea of being little Christs, or Christ to the neighbor. Almost without fail, they disregard and deny or undo Luther's two kingdoms distinction. They say that church and politics do go together. The church and state need to go together. They inform each other. They're involved. And Luther's just wrong on it. So they toss out that. It does not address, in like terms, Che Jivali says, it did not address apartheid. So that's a gracious way of saying something, where Kamita is much stronger, saying it not only doesn't address it, he says, if I have to speak Lutheran theology, what I can say is what doesn't work. And that's the two kingdoms thing. That was in our face a lot, and it was difficult. You had, and Paul John Isaac writes that there's no separation between the two kingdoms. The command to serve the neighbor, and Luther's own struggles. So Luther's biography against political and tyrannical power in the name of the gospel. And I have more to come down there because we're still writing it. I mean, we're still working on it and putting together out of the interviews and all the reading what pieces of Lutheranism played a role in Namibia. But even asking, I can't say even last, so I said, I'm going to Holden. Kristen? So you've read all this stuff. She's done a history, her history capstone, which is her final senior paper on the history of Namibia. She's been to Namibia, done all these interviews I sent her for, found all this material, been researching all summer long. I said, what's the word at the end of the day? Were they motivated by Lutheranism? And she says, I don't think so. So there you have it. but it she's the, I don't think so. It seems to be there's a bit of, if people are asked, they definitely can interpret the Namibian liberation movement through Lutheran theological lenses. They know them. They can talk. Then they can go. But was it the motivator? Not sure we found that. So, responses, questions, or thoughts? Yeah.
Well, in 1982, I had a seminary class, Christ Seminary Seminics, with Robert Bertram. And he did a class called, it was basically confessing movements. And so he started with the Reformation, and then did Nazi Germany and our own civil rights movement here in the United States and South Africa. And you know, looking at all these documents, these confessional documents, you know, related and relating that. The Lutheran confessional documents. So we looked at the Kairos document and all those things that came out of these movements. So so it's interesting because you kind of posed this theme in terms of a revolution. You know, are we revolutionaries or not? Mm-hmm. And he kind of did that in terms of what does it mean to be confessional. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to confess one's faith in the context of what's happening in society around you, mm-hmm. and how then how does that become a thread in terms of our Lutheran identity, our Christian identity, you know, in terms of that. So I've always thought that was kind of an interesting. or to me, that's been helpful in terms of thinking what it means to be a confessional Christian, what it means to be a confessional Lutheran, and how that does or does not relate to other things and movements. So,
so he, in some ways, I mean, that's a great, the questions that I had thought of, so in adding even of saying, like, what ideas, either Reformation ideas, you know, could foster passion, he was, it sounds like a great class, number one, and it sounds like he's saying the idea of confessional movements. This
yes,
is something.
Yes.
This is the connection. This
yeah,
is the
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The
yeah.
Finding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Out of there. I was, so that is very interesting. I did want to hear, so with Bonhoeffer, I'm doing it differently, but I wanted to hear whether they would say that. And I guess Comita would call it a confessing church, and they use that kind of language. They're not
yeah.
developing it that much,
mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean we can't connect those
mm-hmm.
dots.
Yeah, and you didn't, like in our own civil rights with Martin Luther King Jr., you didn't have, I don't think you had that terminology,
mm-hmm.
you know, but we looked at, you know,
yeah.
but if you examine the
yeah.
writings of Martin Luther King
yeah.
in terms of just his very... approach and his, you know, his incredible wordsmithing in terms of how Martin Luther King was able to articulate, you know, what was happening and so what yeah what does so does it, it does it look like that even if it doesn't call itself that
yeah.
does it look like that
yeah common themes that's great
hmm.
there yeah that sounds like a great connection in class.
The whole time I was listening to you, I was thinking, I was fascinated, but then I was also thinking of relating it to the church in America.
Yeah.
And
today?
Yeah, yeah.
Or
and the political situation today. And I'm wondering, I kept thinking about that, the tax-exempt status the churches hold.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you have an opinion on how much that little bit of thing keeps churches from really addressing issues. Plus the fact, I know in our church, there are people who are far right of me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, you know, we as our pastors have, need to fulfill us spiritually. That's your job. Anyway, they need to address us, their whole congregation spiritually. But, you know, I'm talking about social justice. That's my burbling. I'm finished.
Yeah, no, I don't have anything to say about it, but you have, you think you've said enough. So even like the tax, are there just some like, not necessarily theological things, but just mechanical and economic things that stop us from...
Yeah.
I do, a couple of you, we were sitting around, it was like, well, why were the Namibian Lutherans so politically active, you know, and I was like, I wonder if it's just, and North America, I was like, I wonder if it's a matter of economic privilege, and said... Maybe it's that simple, it has nothing, I would like to find all these abstract theological roots, but maybe it's just a matter of experience of oppression or something like that, so, but I don't know.
Well, and there's a real, I mean, there's a real clear thing, you know, that, I mean, I would think that everybody would understand that apartheid was wrong and that civil rights were wrong, you know, there's some more argument between, you know, an adequate healthcare system or, you know, you can argue both sides of that. I mean, to some people it's not clear, as it is to me, that we should be helping poor people.
No, and there's all kinds of rationale. I mean, the white Namibians, even in 1992, of having a brief exposure before going to the black congregation, it was very paternalistic, but loving. Some of saying, you know, we love our servants like children.
Yeah.
And, you know, and with the biggest, like, I would do anything for them. And it's like, you know, but the image, you know, you're just kind of like, oh, but that image is just so awful, you know? It's like, but she's a full-grown woman in your house with kids of her own. And we have our own history of that as well. So, yeah, and you had your hand up, and you had your hand up.
Am I correct that Namibia is the most Lutheran country in the world?
I don't know. It
I
might
believe
be,
it
huh?
is. That's what the way I've been taught the history. So
yeah.
It's kind of logical that it would be the unifying force.
Hmm. Yeah. that Lutheranism would be.
Like you said, 50%.
Yeah.
We're Lutheran, and I'm not sure in Norway they're 50% there.
No. I mean, I was just thinking, no. I mean, at least not. So right, yeah, and you do think that. So it's a united, it's a uniting thing, and there could be something about how Lutheran worship is done. There could be which people, you know, how to articulate that. Who knows what elements of that would be, you know? And so, how Lutheran worship and church functioned and was done and had its own government and representation, things like that. There could be. So those are good. Like even just the practical aspects and the liturgical aspects of Lutheranism, could those have had an influence? And I feel like I have no access to that, so I just go with the theological parts, but this is a main unifying factor.
So I was just thinking about how much people who are on top try to theologically justify where they are and you know, and so create theologies around that that then keep others oppressed. And even, you know, like you were saying, the people who say, well, we love these people like our children, we would do anything for them. And yet, as they read the Bible, they are probably, they can read the same verses that I read about justice and never see that. And I see that in churches all the time. And I see it, I work for Bread for the World. And so, like, when I'm sometimes in an inner city church versus a suburban church, you know, just the way that people are hearing things, or the way that they are willing to hear things sometimes, or the ways that they're, I think sometimes that their brains, you know, as soon as you start challenging something a little bit, it's like their brain shuts down, or something in them tries to, oh, no, you know, but that's, it sort of rocks my boat, so don't stir things too much here, because it's working right. It's working right for you, but it's not working right for this other person. And it really strikes me how those of us who have really do frequently, you know, read our Bible and try to create theologies that I don't think intentionally. Maybe there are some that are doing it intentionally, but I think that a lot of people are unintentionally, you know, creating these theologies and biblical understandings that just continue to support them. And then when we hear people, like in Latin America, because I lived in Latin America for 6 years, with some of the liberation theology pieces that rock that, then there's sort of a piece of our brain, and I actually read something about a study recently that said, that I can't remember exactly how it went, but people have opinions, and when their opinions are challenged by facts, they don't change their opinions to fit the facts. They become stronger in their opinions. This is by the Pew Center. Mm-hmm. But their opinions become stronger and more ideologically based rather than reconstructing the opinions to match what the facts are. And I think so sometimes when we're faced with some of the other movements or things, you know, sometimes we become more rigid in the things that we think are our theology to dismiss, oh, but they're Marxist, oh, but they're this, oh, but they're that, to dismiss other understandings of the Bible until we experience some oppression ourselves or some difficulty or some...
Oh my God. I'm thinking of a couple things. Post going to Namibia then, in my Lutheran theology course, it was actually just stated, liberation theology, black theology, and feminist theology are not theologies. And then we moved on. It was like, what? You know, this is an enormous group of... It was, and not from someone who would be typified as the most closed-minded Lutheran theologian out there. It just was like, this is not theology. And so that was it. That was 1994. There is that of saying it doesn't count. It doesn't, because it's a, you know, you could say it doesn't start with my method. That's why. It doesn't start with this method that has been traditional. And so, therefore, it's out, you know, in different terms, different starting points, different sources of authority, things like that could be the issue at stake there. I was going to say that one of the things that there are clear, it seems like those clear cases where you think, what, doesn't everybody see that this is wrong, or something like this. However, there are those times where I'm very much aware that I'm as ideologically fundamentalist as my polar opposite. and we both, you know, are coming from, you know, that I have a certain crowd that listens to the same sources, that, you know, everyone's talking about NPR all the time. Shouldn't this make us wonder, you know, like, that we're all, you know, you could say, well, that's because I'm open-minded, really? Or all that open-minded, you know? Because not everyone over here is listening to this. So it's like, those kind of things just kind of make me wonder whether, like, okay, so what is our caution against using it toward our own ends? And I think that's, at least like last night, in looking at Bonhoeffer, his idea of, and some of those World War II people, I find it most helpful to think about their idea of you don't get to possess, define, or grasp the holy. It is not yours. It is beyond you. So never pretend that you've got it and someone else doesn't. Because if you do think that, you are, you're barking up the wrong tree and you're worshiping the wrong God. So the minute I think that God's on my agenda, however, it is difficult, but then when you look at hunger and injustice and things like that, the WWJD that we put up on the board several times, and the Sermon on the Mount and things like that. So some of these people going back to those bases, you know, there's a, but it's just one of those kind of cautions that I'm always thinking, oh, okay.
I was wondering about the context in which Luther is kind of accused by us as having the two kingdoms.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a period of history where the nation state was in a very formative stage and wasn't as pervasive in people's lives? They might be in an agricultural system, beholden to a landowner, but there wasn't a government telling them what their health care would be, what their where they would live. The nation state was not such a big deal. If you put Luther 300-400 years later in history, might his views have been different because of the circumstances?
Yeah, if we could think about Luther's theology in its historic context and evaluate it, understand it there, and then look at its relevance and possibilities or hampering problems for today, or the maybe some of the limitations, or the ways that his issues shaped those ideas, but they might not be our issues. If we thought like that as Lutherans, I would be so happy. I mean, that would be something where it's like, we should do that. He didn't claim to be God or perfect, but we are so scared of critiquing Luther and Bonhoeffer because there are two people. You know, at least in the Reformation, in the Reformed tradition, they've got Calvin and Zwingli. They've got a couple of major characters to play with. But what do you do as a Lutheran when you disagree with Luther? I mean, do you get kicked out of the club or something? And you say, I don't like that idea. I like this idea. You know, can you pick and choose and say, these ones no longer apply? I'm in the process of thinking about that, of thinking like, yeah, these ones make a lot of sense. They still make sense. And actually, there could come a time, it might not have been Namibia then, and it could be now, that someone could write a fantastic application of Luther's Two Kingdoms doctrine to our current issues. And I'd say, fantastic, make it live. But let's not just parrot his ideas and import them into a random context as though, even his ideas about human nature. He had his own things he was working out. I'm not so sure we should just jump on board with them. And he had a lot of things. And he was disentangling. I think I had mentioned this Bernhard Lohse, this German person who's trying to work with Luther's ideas, talks about Luther had to disentangle political and church power and try to understand, and he was trying to do this to understand the role of the princes and the church and things like this. He had to create this in his context. It doesn't mean it's forever and forever. And I thought, well, that's a good point, but I hear it used theologically all the time. We won't talk about human sexuality, but it came into play in that conversation quite a bit. It is our time. We will, tomorrow, we'll bring up a couple of things of Luther and women, both liberating things and potential hang-ups of Luther's ideas for women's well-being today. In particular, the idea that I'm interested in is Lutheran theology and the issues of domestic violence. So some of these things, we'll come back to these ideas of what ideas, are there ideas on these sheets of Lutheran, in Lutheran thought, that you find as this potentially powerful, the little Christ, service to the neighbor. A couple of these things came up as instigators of liberating or reforming movements, and then what issues in the world do we face today where Luther's ideas could foster a passion, or ideas that kind of irked you in some way. That's an open game too. But thank you for today, and I know we're at the time, that's why I'm kind of shutting off our conversation, but thank you.